your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Everybody wants to make a difference. They want their career not just to be a fungible work unit, crafting another widget, marketing a widget, selling a widget, whatever. And sometimes even working for a nonprofit or government can feel too far removed from making a difference in people's lives. And that's what brings many people to wanting to work in education. And so I'm always looking for an excuse to bring my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko, on the show. And what better one than to do a relatively deep dive into maybe a dozen different careers in education, including some under-the-radar ones. And so without further ado, the many-time National Award-winning Napa County Superintendent of Schools, but she's not always been on high. She did indeed start as a teacher in New York City, and she's worked her way up through the ranks, and she's now on statewide and nationwide committees and stuff. Dr. Barbara Nemko, thanks for being my co-conspirator as usual.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Okay. You know, we like, especially here in the Bay Area, to not just reify, deify, laud, give encomiums to the lofty. You see, I've been writing poetry lately. But to the regular working person, as Studs Terkel did with his famous book, Working. So what do you know about being a custodian in the school?
It's probably a lot like being a custodian in an office, but maybe a little more mess because you're cleaning up after kids. Mm-hmm. Most people in an office don't vomit on any kind of a regular basis, but little kids do.
Now, on high, Supti, have you had a conversation with a custodian in the last 5 years?
Depends on what kind of conversation you're talking about.
Other than
about.
Hi, how are you? Fine, how are you?
Yeah, but usually not about the work per se, although occasionally.
Now, I come into your office periodically, and I see, mm-hmm. you know, the weekends, weekdays, weeknights. I see you have a custodian or two. They seem like nice people.
They're the greatest.
Okay, right. What makes a great custodian? You know, they all clean the toilets. They all clean the floor. They all probably have to clean up the vomit. But what's one thing, do you know any one thing that might surprise me about being custodian?
Well, when we hire people in that category, it could be anything from inside cleaning, vacuuming, etc., to planting flowers around our different facilities.
What do you
mean?
Which
sounds like gardening.
There's a lot of wildlife around your office, including snakes, rattlesnakes.
Right. Oh, let's not forget, there's a subspecialty in our office unofficially, and that is snake charmer.
And is that the job of the custodian?
You bet.
Okay. Let's move on to another.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You asked about custodians.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Custodians do sort of all the physical plant maintenance things. And that includes lots of stuff because, number one, our office is not just one single office, but we have facilities all over town. So we have classrooms here and classrooms there and portables and things.
But don't they just clean? I mean, they don't do plumbing. They don't do electrical. They clean up, right?
Yes, but they fix things when they're not working, and they'll sometimes do things like set up and clean up. If we're having a meeting, they'll put out the chairs and take in
sure.
the chairs, which
All right.
we don't really think of as custodial.
I'm ready to move on to another one. Okay, another...
I'm sorry, there was just one other
oh,
thing.
Sure, go ahead.
We mentioned the snake.
Yeah.
There was the time that I drove into the parking lot, and there were a whole bunch of people looking at a car.
I'm glad it was... I thought you were going to say a whole bunch of snakes. That would have been really interesting. Go ahead.
Well, but when I stopped, because it didn't look good to see so many people looking mm-hmm. at a car, mm-hmm. I said, what's going on? And a snake had crawled up from underneath, from the ground, and gotten into the engine of somebody's car. And so who do they call? The custodian.
Mm-hmm. There's got to be, it gives a whole new meaning to the term having a rattle in your car.
Oh, cute.
Okay, I'll move on. next people's career in the world of education, of course, is teacher's aide. These days, there's lots of them. I mean, what percentage of classes, does a teacher have an aide in the classroom?
Huh. Well, there are lots of different kinds of aids. There are classroom aids because you need to have an extra person. For example, in our Corton Community School, we have a teacher and an aide in those classes. But that's a small number of Corton Community School classes.
But all special ed, don't all special ed?
Yeah, not all special ed, but the largest number of aides that we have are for special ed students who need a one-on-one aide, or in special ed classrooms where they have to keep the ratio of kids much lower than in regular classes.
And in regular classes, I mean, I remember visiting a lot of schools and there was an aide in regular class. How often are aides in regular classes?
Not very often.
Not very often.
And of course, you know, if we could, we'd love to have more,
right. But
there's no budget for it.
All right. What might surprise me about being a classroom aide? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah. Well, again, I'm talking special ed classroom aide.
Okay.
You could be with a child who has anything from Down syndrome or autism, where they have severe behavior problems, all the way to kids who are physically so challenged that they need someone sometimes to suction out their breathing passages.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to teacher, regular teacher.
It's,
you know, we have a special burden there because everybody's had teachers their whole, you know, lives. What's one thing that might surprise me, not from the student perspective, from the inside perspective, either as a teacher or an administrator now, what's something that might surprise me about teachers or being a teacher, the career of teacher, that's surprising, that might surprise my listeners?
That there's you're on a constant steep learning curve these days, because with the advent of technology, we're changing from what we used to do to what we're doing now. Plus, there's a big, big push for project-based learning. So we want kids to have more authentic experiences. We went to school, it was open your book, read the chapter, answer the questions at the end. But there is no job in real life that will ever ask you to do that sequence of things. Instead, what they're going to say is, here's this problem, and we need to work it out. How are we going to do this? So you're trying things, you're testing solutions, you're working with other people to figure out what to do for the most part, and you're using technology. Nobody goes to work and the employer says, let me have your phone, you can have it back when you leave.
Yeah. Two questions. You know, I remember having a conversation at a dinner. You were at it with me, and there were like 20 people there. And the woman sitting next to me was from China. And she said she laughs at all of this project-based learning stuff because there's no coherence. You can't learn science because it's catch-as-catch-can on these projects. You know, you learn a little bit of math here and a little bit of this there, but you have no foundation. There's no hierarchy. There's no sequence. What would you say to her?
I would say that we don't do 100% project-based learning, but when we went to school, we did 0% project-based learning. So we memorized a whole lot of stuff and had no idea what to do with it. We're not suggesting that every day, every subject, all day long is project-based learning, but we do introduce a lot of projects so that kids can take stuff they've learned and they can use it in a way that they will know how to make it a hireable skill in the real world.
Throughout what you've been saying about what might be surprising about teaching, the job of teacher, is how central technology is, whether it be in the projects or just simply learning technology. I've heard that for a million years, but I also know as a career counselor that many people choose teaching as a way to shelter themselves from technology because, you know, while they can turn on their computer and maybe do word processing or whatever, you know, and certainly use their phones and Facebook, they really don't like technology much at all. Are you really discouraging people who don't really like technology from entering teaching? Do they really need to be? How technical do they need to be, if at all, if you're really being honest?
It's not so much a question of they must have all these technical skills when they come in, but they do have to be open to learning them because that's what we're doing.
What's them mean? What kind of technology might, in one of those, you say, the endless learning curve, what might a workshop or whatever they do for teachers be in the area of technology?
Well, for example, our preschool teachers all had to learn how to use particular applications on their iPads. And that also meant they had to learn how to project from the iPad onto a screen so that the kids could do a whole group lesson and the kids would be able to see it. So it's connectivity, and then they had to learn how to get the results that could be gotten through the application. So it's stuff that they had never done before, and they were not excited about learning it. Fortunately for us, when they saw how powerful it was, they got more excited about learning it, and now they're willing to do all kinds of things that utilize technology.
Okay, well,
so it's learning that, but also having to learn how to do things like project-based learning.
Okay.
Most teachers were educated the way we were, and so they tend to teach the way we were taught, and they're having to learn new methods. And really what is probably more disconcerting to many people is that classrooms are no longer those quiet places that we used to be in. I remember in the school library, we used to have to tiptoe, and we had to lift our chairs up so you wouldn't hear a scraping sound. And now you walk into classrooms, and there's a hum, there's a buzz. Kids are talking to each other. They're moving around. They may not even be sitting in chairs. They may be on the floor. They may be leaning against a pillow against the wall. I mean, it's a very different environment.
Well, I'll tell you, though, that makes me wonder, especially for distractible kids. Kids who have difficulty focusing, in the same way as the modern workplace with cubicles, the cube farms, there's a significant percentage of people who say, I can't concentrate in that. Have they ever looked at, you know, we say we celebrate diversity, but is there real, you know, I can't imagine that all students react well to that chaotic environment. How well do ADHD kids, ADD kids, distractible kids, spacey kids, introverted kids, there seems like a zillion kids who, it seems like a priori, it would be easier for most students to react to a quiet learning environment than a chaotic and noisy, let's take away the judgmental, chaotic, noisy one. Am I missing something?
If there is a kid who really can't concentrate for whatever reason with any noise, then we give them headphones so that they can block out the noise and they can work quietly by themselves. Most kids are much more excited because they're actually doing something or making something.
Sure. Okay.
And they love talking to each other.
All right. So this is actually a nice way to segue into, you know, you're talking about the centrality of technology in today's classroom. There are, in addition to your generic teacher needing to have some measure of technological expertise, are there technology gurus in the schools who are there to support, to use today's word,
absolutely,
not help, support,
absolutely,
teachers in technology. Tell me about that. That's kind of an under-the-radar job, the tech teacher. What do they call, what kind of titles do they have, and what do they do?
Well, they're probably not, I mean, there are some people who do teach some components of technology, mostly in the high schools, but it's more people who are in the IT department. And they're the ones who are making sure that your connectivity is working, that you have the best safeguards so that you're not getting hacked, that are there to help a teacher who's in distress because something is not going the way it's supposed to. And they keep tabs on all the IT that's going on in the building.
So those are standard IT jobs that I got. And so that's a nice little tip for all those IT people who are having a tough time, perhaps, landing a job in so competitive Silicon Valley. The schools do hire those IT people. But I'm talking about a teacher who is a teacher and knows the ins and outs of teaching and also knows technology and shepherds or supports or helps or whatever regular teachers to better integrate technology in the classroom. Do they have those teachers like in elementary schools or no?
They come and go. When we had a little bit more money 2 years ago in our district, we called them academic coaches. And they would help teachers in all the things that we're talking about, in doing projects and in integrating technology. Then when we had declining enrollment and we lost money, those coaches were yesterday, so we don't always.
Yeah, you know, you've made a number of mentions already in the money issue. I've never talked to an educator who says, well, if we had only more money, and yet there was a major study done, and it was reported on CBS News, and you can, dear listeners, you can Google this, that says that the U.S. spends number one or number two, depending on which study you want to cite, number one or number two per capita on education in the world, And yet our achievement is number 25, number 27, number 29, whatever. And we're saying the answer is more money. What am I not understanding? Remember
that 85% or more of a district's budget is personnel. And salaries and benefits in the United States are higher than in many other places in the world.
How much of administration? I mean, you know, one of the big knocks on education is that such a high percentage of the money goes to administrative stuff rather than in the classroom. Is that right or is that wrong?
I can solve that problem. They can stop passing all these regulations and all these requirements and all the things that we have to do, all the reports we have to do, all the oversight that we have to do, all the things that auditors come in and look at. So, yeah, we have, quote, administration, but people think administration is some high-priced superintendent sitting with his or her feet up eating bonbons, and the people in the administrative category may be the accountants and the people who deal with all the budgets and have to keep track of every single teacher, their salary, what their level of benefits is, how much money goes to retirement, how much money goes to workman's comp, how much money goes to probably 10 more categories of things.
And to what extent is it fair to say, I know that there are separate rules that districts have, county offices of education have, the State Department of Education have, the feds have, and then, of course, there's also accountability to the media that's ever watchdogging. How much of that, you know, are there multiple layers of these rules that have to be excavated, untangled, and conflicts resolved between, or is that part of the problem, or is that not really much of a problem?
I don't think it's that there's conflict. It's just that they keep piling on. There is never a time that they take away any requirement that we have to do. They only add.
I see. Okay. Let's let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We're talking about careers in education, and I would like to now invite you to call. If you are either in education, and what I'd like to, you can tell your story. I love stories. It could be either your story, your saga, your journey through the education world, or it could be a moment, an incident, or you've got a question. You're intrigued that you'd like to have some role within the education system. Some would say the education blob, whatever. Your question or comment related to education, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Well, okay. While we're waiting, let's go back to some of the other groups of jobs that we have. Accounting is a huge part of a district. So there's a whole business office. So and these are people think of education as a teacher and a principal and maybe a school aide, and they think of getting a teaching credential. But these are not credential jobs. These are called classified jobs. So you don't need an education credential. So if you're an accountant, we have multiple levels of accountant jobs in our office because, as I said a few minutes ago, there are so many different variables and deductions from checks that have to be kept track of, how much money was put into STIRS, which is the teacher's retirement, and how much went into PERS, and now we have to make sure that we have enough money going out in the future for all the people who retired who are collecting on their pensions that we have to pay.
One more question. You know, I'm always trying to put my shoes put myself in the listener's shoes. What if I'm picturing a typical listener to KALW who's a liberal arts graduate, who's not an accountant, who's not an IT person, who is majored in psychology or sociology or women's studies or art history or whatever, and they don't want to be a teacher, but they like the idea of being in the education world. Are there jobs for not technical people being, I wish there was a less disparaging word, bureaucrats of some sort, doing some kind of paperwork, planning, reporting?
Sure.
Sure.
There are project directors.
Uh-huh.
We get lots of state and federal grants. Mm-hmm. You know, they make us compete for dollars, mm-hmm. and then somebody has to manage that project.
Okay.
So that involves a number of skills, including hiring and report writing and evaluation.
Right.
And lots of things that are very interesting that you don't necessarily need a teaching credential for.
That's particularly interesting, I think, to our listeners. That's what I call an interstitial job. It's between the cracks. Nobody's heard of it. How usually, at least outside of the education world, but in the world of my career counseling clients, those soft skill jobs are very desirable, and so they get a zillion applicants, and they end up going to somebody who knows somebody. Are you in a position to assess whether, in fact, if my typical listener, that is, I'm describing, of course, there's many typical listeners, but a college graduate, soft-skilled, good communication, organized, detail-oriented, but not technical, and they, you say there are these project manager jobs that are in district offices, county offices, state offices. How critical is it they network their way into the job as opposed to simply answering an ad on EdJoin, which is a leading website with job listings?
Yeah, I would say you answer an ad on EdJoin because there's always a hiring committee. We work very hard to make sure that that committee is unbiased. We keep records of all of that.
When you look
there's
at your
rubric when we have people come in and they're answering questions that
I know
score
about rubric,
by.
Right. But when you, if you were to look at all the people who are project managers in your office, you have 200 people who work for you. If you were to look at the people who have those soft skill jobs, the project manager, how many of them simply came in cold by answering an ad? And how many of them knew somebody or contacted you or tried to get an in? They didn't just – they weren't just a good little boy and girl and answer the ad and go through that. How many of them, in your judgment, what percentage, a quarter, a half, three quarters, got the job because they knew somebody or they didn't just answer the ad? They pushed their way in one way or another.
I don't think we have anybody who pushed their way in. I think you might have a slight advantage – if you know somebody who works in the office who alerts you to the fact that we are going to be hiring for X position, just in terms of calling and getting your application in on time. But first you have to pass the paper screening, and if you don't have the right qualities and skills, you're not going anywhere. And certainly in the interview, it would not make a difference because whoever it was that you knew would not be on the interview panel, and we would be doubly careful that you were getting the job only because you really were the best candidate.
Fair enough. I'll give out the phone number again, and then we'll go to the phones. If you've got a question, a comment, a story related to careers in education, the phone number here, work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Talk about some other jobs
in education?
Let's go
to the phone. Of course we can, but we want to honor our listeners first. We will come back to other careers.
Okay.
Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello.
Hi. I am calling in. I'm a school psychologist.
Good.
And so I actually do work with quite a lot of people who are both teachers and also other kinds of employment, like counselors, like therapists, like speech therapists, occupational therapists.
Right.
Now, it's true, most of these people don't get a job like that immediately with just a BA, but it doesn't take a huge amount of training for folks to get jobs in that field, and there's always need for those specialists. The other thing I would say, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about why we spend so much money and we get so little out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I work in special education, I can tell you that a lot of the money that we spend is on fixing problems after they're problems. And we don't spend a lot of money on prevention. And I've been in the education field now for since 1985.
Mm.
And class sizes are the same as they were when I first started in education. And we know through a lot of research that actually class sizes do matter. The research that says that that's not the case collapses special education small size classes in with all of the others. And of course, if you're taking that into account, you're not going to show the same kinds of changes. But if we had small class sizes for all students, we wouldn't have to have special education. We wouldn't have to be paying out to lawyers lawsuit money that we have to pay so much money in terms of settlements and things like that. We wouldn't have to pay for school psychologists to do as much testing, and instead we could work providing therapeutic interventions, behavioral support, and teacher consultation that helps them be more effective in the classroom.
Let me,
we just haven't really put our money in the best location. is my perspective.
Okay. And so while we were going to talk about school psychology, so let's take advantage of you while you're here. Here is my summary of what a school psychologist is. Tell me what's either wrong about that or something else or something surprising, but to kick off our little mini discussion. I see a school psychologist primarily, as you've almost implied, as primarily a key coordinator in the special ed game, where a teacher will refer a kid to you, you will test them individually, you will observe in the classroom, you will consult with the regular teacher, you will consult with potentially as needed a special ed teacher, you will convene an IEP meeting with the principal, the parent, and all the other major players, and then you will monitor periodically, and with as catch as catch can, you'll run a parent workshop, you'll run a bullying workshop, a drug, etc. What's right and wrong about that? What's missing and what needs more nuance?
Well, I think you are right in districts where that's the better situation. There's a range. Some districts hire folks who are trained, as I am, to do. I'm trained to do consultation, clinical, therapeutic support, behavior support. Also academic prevention, et cetera. And many, many, many of folks like me who are highly trained, I actually have a PhD from Berkeley, mm-hmm. And that's where school psychology as a profession actually started. And the thing is that we are oftentimes just hired as assessors and as psychometricians, mm-hmm.
right.
where all we do is measure the problem once
right,
the problem.
Right.
And so in really good districts, and I actually, I mean, one of the things that I'm doing that I've had sort of a pet project is I'm creating a multi-tiered training level where I have trainee psychologists come in and work to get their mm-hmm. hours towards their clinical licensure, as well as mm-hmm. to support mm-hmm. folks on their way. And then in being able to do that, then what we do is we're able to provide all of the things that we're supposed to according to the National Association of
You know what, I'm going to interrupt you because we're getting a little too in the weeds now. Do me a favor, though, and say hi to Carolyn Hartsoff for me, will you?
Hi, Carolyn. You know me. That was Jason Hayes.
I'm sorry. What'd you say?
Carolyn knows me. Sally Payson Hayes.
Oh, very good. Okay. I didn't want to reveal it. I have my PhD from the School Psychology Program at Berkeley, too. Anyway, you don't seem that surprised. Anyway, okay. All right, I'll thank you for the call.
Thank you so much.
All right, you're welcome. Barbara, you have anything you want to add, or should we go to the next? Let's go to the next phone.
I think she made some really good points mm-hmm. that people don't think about.
Okay.
And remember that we don't make the laws. Legislators who don't work in the schools make the laws. So they guarantee that we are going to do X, Y, and Z. And then if we're not able to do that, we get sued, and we have to hire lawyers, we have to go to court,
right.
And the hourly rate of lawyers and the settlements are can be astronomical, particularly in the area of special education.
And in your little county of Napa, what would you say you have spent in the last 5 years or whatever on lawyers?
Oh, I couldn't begin to tell you that.
Is it in the hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, million?
I can't tell you that.
Okay.
Because I'm not looking at what the districts have spent in if they have lawsuits. One of the things that we are very good at is doing an excellent job in special education, so we don't get sued very often in our office in the cases that we are doing. But sometimes we have to do very expensive interventions for kids, like sending them out of state because a parent will threaten to sue us, and it's cheaper to spend a small fortune sending the kid out of state than to spend the larger fortune fighting to not send him out of
What's
state.
What's a small fortune mean, just for our listeners to give a sense of perspective?
For sending
a kid out of state? Yeah. Total cost out of the budget that has to be taken off the top because special ed is number one priority according to the law.
Oh, it can be $80,000 for a kid, $100,000 for a kid
per year.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's go back to the phones. I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a question or a comment related to education careers, either you want to tell your story, either you want to ask a question about an education career, or anyway, question, comment, story, the phone number here, work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841. 4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello? Are you there? Last time, are you there? I guess not. So, let's...
So, can I talk about food services?
Oh, that's... Yes. You know, we all know there's the nice people who serve the Sloppy Joes or the healthier version of that in the cafeteria. What else is there?
Well, one of the new trends is to not have a central kitchen that cooks everything and then ships it out to the schools to serve, but to have each school do its own cooking. So they are trying very hard to make meals healthier. And even our elementary schools now have fresh salad bars. If you can picture a kindergarten kid going through the salad bar line, it's the cutest thing you ever want
to
see.
Yeah.
But that means that they're hiring people at school sites to cut up the oranges and cut up the broccoli and to prepare some of the food. So that's a whole new arena in food service for people who want to work in schools.
Why is that healthier? I mean, it would seem like that's going to be a lot more expensive to have a bunch of, you know, kitchens at each school that are preparing rather than one place where they, as you, to use your example, to slice the oranges.
Well, because people want things fresh now.
But it's in the district. You're not sending it from Iowa, you know, and talking about down the street, the next, you know, this central commissary. Napa is not, you know, like Los Angeles. It's a tiny place.
Well, people would like to see hot, fresh food that comes out of the kitchen, and they are kind of decentralizing what used to be more centralized.
Okay, all right. Well, that's where some of the money goes to. But anyway, okay, let's talk about, you can pick it. Do you want to talk about special ed teachers, ESL, principal? What do you want to talk about?
Well, talk about people who write grants. If you're a good writer,
good.
You don't need a credential, but we're writing grants all the time.
Right. And money is always the lifeblood. Everything ends up being about money. And if you're the grant writer and you're good, you're going to bring in millions of dollars because they don't just give away the money. You have to write these long proposals.
Very long proposals.
You had Lynn Vaughn, who for many years brought in millions of dollars to the Napa schools, and she was godlike. What made Lynn Vaughn such a good grant writer?
She understood how to make it human, because grant applications require some very specific kinds of things, and they can be very dry. Mm-hmm. Lynn could weave a story into it about who was going to get in it, about what the grant writer might be thinking Napa County was, that we were some rich Chardonnay-sipping citizens, but in fact that most of our population in school were the children of people who work in the hospitality industry, who are lower paid, who have very high percentage of kids who are just learning English as a second language.
Right, farm workers' kids, right.
And she would weave that as a story. So if you're a grant writer, you immediately become warmed to this place and you want to give them the grant.
Right. And many people don't realize that it is the poor. Most of the money goes to the poor schools. These grants are not given to the Chardonnay. I love that term, Chardonnay sipping. Am I correct that most of the money does go for people of color, the poor, et cetera? Is that accurate or is that not accurate?
Well, yes. These days, most of the grant money is geared toward closing the achievement gap. And the achievement gap is found largely in schools with high percentages of poor kids. So, yes, either grants will be targeted specifically, and you're not even eligible to apply unless you're poor enough and you have a free and reduced lunch count of higher than 50% in your school, or you get extra points if you fall into that category.
Okay.
So, yes, that is true.
So, thanks. Grant writer's great. What's another interstitial, under-the-radar education career you want to make sure you share with us?
Public relations.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. See, now that, again, that's a soft skill thing, you know, writing, speaking, whatever. And does the Napa Office of Education have a PR person?
We do.
Does the district?
We do, the fabulous Shauna Wagner.
Okay.
And her job was repurposed. That was not what she was hired to do. But she, because that was part of her background, she did a little bit of it, and then another job. It's not her full-time job. She also coordinates a whole bunch of programs and things, but she is a public information officer, and she does a great deal of PR, and she does it very well, and you need to have that today.
Explain to our listeners why a school, a county office of education, the school district or whatever, does the you're the county, Napa County. There's also a Napa district. Does the district have a PR person too?
Yes, they do.
Wow. And how about, you know, that you supervise five districts. Does St. Helena have a PR person too? Do you know?
No, I don't think they have a full-time PR person, but they're a small district with, you know, 1,200
kids. That's why I was trying to test the water, see how far this extended. So why does, and you know, you focus primarily on special needs kids and special programs. Why do you need a PR person?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that the community needs to know, that the only way to make sure that happens is to have somebody who alerts everybody. So, for example, the basic thing, we have to make sure people know when we have board meetings or we're violating the Brown Act. So that all has to get sent out to a whole bunch of people. But if we're doing a parent workshop, if we're doing an activity like the fifth grade challenge, if we're doing the science fair, if we're doing Napa County Reads, the only way to get that word out is to use every bit of media and social media today. I could send what we used to do in the bad old days, is I would send an announcement maybe to the superintendents or to the principals. But everybody gets so much email today most of that stuff fell into the black hole. But Shauna can make sure that it is on the places that actual people look, which today is Facebook and Snapchat and
Instagram
and Pinterest and God knows all the different places,
right,
and Twitter and Facebook.
Right.
And so she makes sure that anything that we are doing that we want to be sure parents and kids know about is there on all those different places, and then she follows up. So, yeah, that's the only summer. For example, we're going to be advertising very shortly for our middle school summer camps, and these are free. If I just send out one general announcement, I'm going to have 12 kids.
Now, PR is often one of their roles is damage control. You know, there are, for example, there are issues. There was a ostensible sexual thing with the kids in the high school. There was the Napa Indians was the beloved symbol of the football team for a million years, and then the change. How much does PR in education get involved in damage control?
Well, if you have somebody who is doing it, which is why you like to have somebody there, then yes, if you need some damage control, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Otherwise, the only thing the public ever hears is bad news.
Okay. Let's invite our listeners again one more time. Last time, if you have an education story, you've been a teacher, you have been any kind of an education person, you might like to be, or you're simply a listener who has you're curious about something related to education. We've got somebody who's got a few years of experience in all aspects. She started as a teacher in New York City. She's worked her way up. She's now not only the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, but is on statewide committee. She testifies all the time. She knows everybody. You can get some really solid inside baseball answers. So your question or comment regarding education careers, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, Barbara Nemco, and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You want to talk principal? You want to talk district administrator? You want to talk lobbyist?
Well, I think people have a pretty good idea of what principals do because we've all had them.
Okay.
What they don't realize today is that principals are expected to be far more of an instructional leader than I think when we went to school. And so they need to be keeping up with the research, the technology, and all those things, and spending a lot of time in classrooms, seeing what's going on, making suggestions, figuring out what kind of additional training teachers might need, making sure that all of the technology infrastructure is there. So principal is a much more complicated job, and they too have reports and meetings and all kind. You know, we do walkthroughs in schools where we teachers look at other teachers and see what they're doing and then discuss what they thought was going well, what wasn't going well, and what we can learn from it.
Okay. What about now? There's this whole, as we mentioned, there are many levels of administration in California education. There's the district level, there's the county level, there's the state level, there's the federal level, and then there are activist groups. Everything from the ACLU is very involved in education, as you keep telling me, to all kinds of other activist groups. And then there's the school board. There's the local school board, the federal school board. There's the state superintendent of education and his bureaucracy. Tell me a little bit that might surprise me about about the work, you know, somewhere in that that education bureaucracy, we know you've told me it's about they have to administer all the laws that have been passed, the regulations. Mm-hmm. But what might surprise me about any of those jobs, and how might somebody, you know, without having been a teacher already for 7 years, which is the standard route that you go from there to administration, what do you want to tell me about getting a job in a district, a county, and in a state, the federal, the U.S. Office of Education, any of that?
Well, I think the state has their own process. You apply to the State Department of Education, and they put you through their kind of test. But people who work at the State Department of Education are there primarily to enforce state and federal laws. That's their job, to make sure that we are in compliance with all of the different laws so that we don't get sued by somebody.
Okay, we've spent too much time talking about that, all that bureaucracy stuff. Let's. I want to kind of end this. Is there anything you want to say either about lobbying? Because I know you do a lot of lobbying on behalf of CSESA and whatever. There are a number of these organizations you were part with. You know, there are legislative education committees. Those are, you know, you want to talk about this? You know, you're...
Sure.
You know,
remember that, again, the people who are making the laws about education are typically not educators.
Right.
So the only way that they can know what we're doing and what we need is if we tell them, because they don't have the time to come and spend a great deal of time in school interviewing teachers and finding out what's going on. And most teachers are teaching in the classroom. They don't have the time to talk to the legislators. So that's one of the things that we do, is we meet with legislators and we explain what some of the challenges that they've created for us are doing, and we testify if somebody is trying to get a bill that we think will be helpful for us, or we oppose it if we think it's going to be detrimental for us.
Can you give me something specific? Tell me one example of where you either testified or you lobbied, you know, within the, you know, a staffer or the legislative person in their office. Let's paint a little picture of something concrete you actually did
as
a lobbyist.
Sure. Well, our own Senator Bill Dodd introduced a bill that would expand preschool for 4-year-olds. And when he introduced that bill in the Senate Education Committee, I was there to support that, and when called on to explain why I felt it was so important.
Called on meaning in the Senate, to the Senate? I mean, is that what you
did? In front of this committee. There was a committee of about 10 senators,
okay,
and there were some people in the audience, and people came to support the bill and to oppose the bill. And since it was my senator who had proposed the bill, he asked me to sit with him at the table. And at one point I talked about the 30 million word gap and why preschool was so important, particularly for second language learners, who are the majority of kids who are in preschool today.
So you get to talk for like 2 minutes, or what did they interrogate you? I want my listeners to feel what it's like to be a lobbyist. What was it really like?
Well, in this particular situation, I think the whole meeting was scheduled for an hour, and you had people in the audience who came to speak for and against. So mm-hmm. I probably had 2 or 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get a lot of time, particularly on the federal level.
Do they ask hard questions? I mean, like a question like, you know, I just read the Obama meta-evaluation of Head Start, and it showed that it has no enduring effects. Why do you want to spend more taxpayer money on expanding preschool? Do you ever get questions like that?
Yes, some will. A few will. Not too many, but there are, remember that the people who are elected to something, let's say the state assembly, serve on many committees. So some will have greater knowledge and expertise in one rather than another. So they may be on the wine committee, and they may be on the education committee, and some other committee having to do with state infrastructure. And so different people have different knowledge on the various committees. So depending on who's on the particular education committee, you may have one or two people who really know a lot about it.
Okay. So, I am not just saying this because, you know, to brag about you at all, but because you have certain knowledge.
Are.
No.
Whatever you're going to say.
Well, no. Well, you have worked very closely with the last two, at least, state superintendents of schools, and particularly Tom Torlakson, the current one, and you've been very involved with Tony Thurmond, the likely next one. And so you know better than most people what the state superintendent of schools does. How is what he does different from the state board of education or district people? What does the state superintendent do?
Well, the state superintendent largely has just a bully pulpit because he does not get to make the laws. He sits on the Board of Regents, so he gets a vote there.
So is that, what's the difference between the Board of Regents and the Board of Education?
Well, the Board of Regents is for the college.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's right. And he goes to all the state board meetings, but he doesn't get to vote on those. But he's there to answer questions, and his staff will be presenting different things.
What might surprise me about being a state superintendent?
You have to have the right temperament for it, because it's largely a position in which you need to be very visible around the state. So you're going from school to school to school all over the place, and we're a big state, and you're invited every place, and you have to figure out where you want to show up and what you want to do there. But you can't really change too much.
It's a large bureaucracy. It's hard to even at the top. I mean, that's something, you know, you've told me a number of times. You are very subject, you know, I don't know if I use the term or you did, you're a marionette. There are so many vectors, so many strings pulling you, and so that your range of motion, to use the physical therapy term, is limited. Is that fair?
It is. I mean, even the district superintendent is hired by a school board. He reports to them. They evaluate him. If they don't like what he or she is doing, they can fire him.
Now, there's another job.
He's not making all the rules.
Okay. Now, we haven't talked about school boards. You know, there's a county school board, there's a district school board, there's state school boards. What does your local school board do?
The county office board?
Yeah, well, it's what you know best.
Well, the county office board has jurisdiction over a couple of things. Obviously, they have to approve curriculum. We have to tell them what we're doing, and they have to approve that. They have to decide. They are an adjudicative body. So if a parent requests, say, an inter-district transfer, and the district says no, they can appeal that to the county board.
I see.
And the county board has pretty wide discretion on if they think that this is in the best interest of the child, mm-hmm. they can overturn the district board.
Yeah, and they got to deal with also, you know, when that kid was accused, or a few football players were accused.
Well, that's why I was getting to that. That's different.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the next thing is, if a kid is expelled, mm-hmm. The parents can appeal, but only, and this is such an important distinction, only on the grounds of due process. So when those football hazing expulsions were appealed to the county board and the county board overturned them, it was only on due process. We don't get to rethink the decision the district made. We don't get to rehear the case, none of that. It's just, did the family get due process, or was due process in some way
violated? Okay, that's been too much in the weeds. Last question about education, then we're going to get off that, but I'm not letting you go because I've got more stuff I want to do with you here. But it seems really fun to be on a school board. Is that a job? Does it pay well? How much work is involved? How difficult is it to get to be on a local school board? Now, I mean, obviously in Oakland or San Francisco, it's difficult because it's such a, you know, big area. But there's millions of small municipalities and jurisdictions. How difficult, for example, in Napa, is it to get on the Yountville school board, if there is one?
Well, there is no Yountville school board.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Part of Napa Unified. So there's one school board that serves a number of different towns: American Canyon, Napa, and Yountville.
But there's one in St. Helena, right? Isn't there
a
school board
in
Pope Valley?
That's a separate school district, right.
Right. So there's a bunch of them. So there's a lot of, what I'm trying to help my listeners know is that there are lots of school boards.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something that is a desirable job? How much does it pay? How much work? Tell me about that.
Well, different school boards pay different amounts, but there is a certain amount that the state says you can't go over, and mm-hmm. it depends on your size.
Sure.
So it's probably $200-something per meeting.
Okay.
And depending
plus benefits.
On
you get benefits.
District, our board members do get health benefits.
Right, which is a fortune, right. How much work do they have to do, and is it fun? Is it fun hearing these curriculum things and adjudicating these things? What's it really like to be in a school? Is that something that my listeners should lust after?
Well, there's a great deal of reading to do. Every school board packet comes jam-packeted with bylaws to be approved and regulations to be approved and all kinds of things that the board has to vote on that they need to be familiar with. So they're getting a pretty thick packet that they have to read through, and then you have all the presentations at the board. So some of it's fun. Napa Valley Unified, for example, does Students of the Month at each meeting. So the principal or and or the teacher will come in with the student and the student's family and talk about why this student was selected Student of the Month. There are presentations on different programs that are happening in the school. So if you like schools and you like kids, those are very interesting to listen to. But then there are also the hard parts of it where you're in closed session and you're looking at whether or not to expel students A, B, C, D, and E for doing X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And you may have two attorneys in there, and that can be a long, drawn-out process, and you have to make a decision that's going to affect a kid's life very seriously.
Sounds interesting. But anyway, let's take one more call, and then we'll switch topics. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that schools also give the opportunity for artists to make an income and also help contribute to the next generation.
Say more.
Creative thinkers.
We love the arts. Both of us are totally into the arts, so tell us more.
Yeah, well, I've worked for 25 years as a music and movement teacher in both public and private schools, and it's allowed me to support my family as a single parent, get benefits, get contributions to my retirement, and be able to do creative work that I love with young people who are so wonderful to work with.
Now, I think that'd be a killer job. How hard is it that, I don't know about, 25 years ago, do you have any intuitions as to, I think most people would kill to be a music teacher, and, not necessarily the orchestra, which gets annoying, but, elementary school orchestra.
I mean, to be honest, the more solid positions are in the private schools, because those schools have a consistent commitment and budget to back it up with. However, the public schools, because I've taught in both, I find, to be honest, to be more exciting to teach in. They tend to be more collaborative with the classroom teachers. They tend to also have access to other programs with architects and other kinds of agencies that you can do some really great you know, one of my favorite projects is I collaborated with a woman who was a movement artist who was the artist in residence at the City Dump in San Francisco. And we did a performance project where she had reclaimed all these materials which they used to make sound on and wear as costumes and all of that. And plus I actually just really love working with the population I taught out in the Bayview. But I called in last week to another KALW program that was focusing on how do you make it in San Francisco in the arts? How do you get by? And I called in and I said, I don't know why young artists are not thinking more about working with children, because it's not only going to give them an income, but of course it's going to help them really expand the effect of what they're doing.
Sure.
And they just went on to talk about the healthcare aspect of it, and they kind of ignored the educational aspect that I was touching on, as if teaching children is kind of somehow lowering yourself. And to me, when I discovered how creative and wonderful kids were to work with and what an important role those arts have in the schools, I became very excited about it. But as Barbara can tell you, every district handles their arts different. Sometimes they just give each school a budget and they bring in guest artists. Not very many public schools anymore actually have a committed arts faculty on their school staff, which is what really benefits the kids the most. So I'm always hoping that, we can fund those positions.
Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. Barbara, I love ending on this positive note about education. Barbara, you and I both have seen the power of chorus and theater to make a huge difference in kids' lives. Why don't you have the last one about the arts careers and theater careers and including the lighting guy you mentioned to me when we were preparing for the show. Talk to me about arts careers in the schools, Barb.
Well, if you have a particular talent and you can be the choir teacher or the band teacher or the drama teacher, you probably have the most long-lasting effect on kids' lives because that's the thing that they will remember forever. It's the thing that engages them, that makes them want to come to school. And honestly, when we talk about preparing kids for today's and tomorrow's workplace, we constantly talk about critical thinking and collaboration and communication. And you certainly have to do those things if you are part of some production. You have to be very responsible, because if the trombone doesn't show up, there's a problem. If an actor doesn't show up, there's a problem. And it's a wonderful feeling of family. People who are in the choir are friends with those kids forever.
Right.
Always will have a warm feeling. If you're in a play with somebody, the rest of your life you're going to go see your friend who is in this play with you because they're in another play. It's like you develop a family.
Right.
And this is what keeps kids from getting into trouble and getting into gangs.
Absolutely.
So what does a gang do? It tries to create a family. So we want our kids to have these experiences in a positive way.
Absolutely.
And the arts can do that.
And dragging us back just to the career thing, and I didn't know this, but would you believe Napa High School, or I think it's Napa, has its own paid lighting person for theater. So if you're a blue-collar person who likes lighting and electrical and stuff like that, there are jobs. You don't realize how many jobs there are in the education, you know, let's call it bureaucracy, let's say establishment. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely, and one more thing.
Good.
We are finally, after 40 years, seeing the resurgence of what used to be called vocational education and is now career and technical education.
Mm.
And people who have experience in those fields can work in schools, and there's a different kind of credential for them. So that's an area where we desperately need people.
Huh.
Right now, you can't get
people
to do these trade kind of jobs.
So let's say I'm working for Tesla, and I'm in the robotics department at Tesla, and I say, you know, I'd love to work with kids and teach them robotics. Is it realistic for me to try to get a job as a robotics career teacher?
Yes.
And how about more basic stuff? I'm a carpenter. I'm an electrician. I'm an irrigation guy. I'm a painter. I'm a whatever. I'm a blue-collar tradesperson.
It's coming back.
Okay. Well, on that positive note, I'm going to let you go. I've got a couple of minutes left, but I don't need to start a new topic with you. Barbara, thank you very much for being my co-conspirator here on Work with Marty Nemco.
You are very welcome.
And I will speak to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Yeah, we've only got a minute or so, but I want to fill it with a couple of things here. What do I want to share with you? This is an article that came out of U.S. News and World Report. Do I want to do that? I want to do this. Time Magazine came out with something called Tactics to Win a Negotiation, according to an FBI agent. And I thought I'd share that with you because it certainly relates to negotiation and any kind of discussions in the workplace. Chris Voss is a former lead international kidnapping negotiator for the FBI and author of the book Never Split the Difference. And he offers four tips for winning a negotiation. One, mirror words selectively. What he means by that is repeat the last 1 to 3 words that your counterpart just said back to them. That's one of the quickest ways to establish rapport and make your counterpart feel safe enough to reveal themselves. Use it with what this guy Voss likes to call the late-night FM DJ voice and upward inflection, like something, let's say he or she said, I think that's a difficult point to discuss. So you're thinking that's a difficult point to discuss. Uh-huh. That kind of a calm voice feels like it's a way of building a bridge. One more, we only have time for that. The next one he says is practice tactical empathy. Proactively label their fears. Phrases like, it sounds like you're afraid of, whatever, or it sounds like you're concerned about can go a long way to disarming a person. Also, list the worst things that the other party could say about you and say them before they can. That preemption, expressing rather than desiring accusations, may be keeping them from festering. And that is all the time we have today for Work with Marty Nemco. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, for you all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. I'm going to talk with not just a film composer about what it's like to be a film composer, but one who's won a Tony, 5 Emmys, and many, like a couple of dozen nominations for Emmy for Best Composing and Orchestration. I will probe Larry Hockman. Probably play a few cuts of his award-winning music. And until then, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.